Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. So let's move on to a very different point, but obviously one that, again, anyone who's been around the block with the Chinese factories generally will be very conscious of. Not to say that America as a whole is conscious of, because that's one of Trump's probably very accurate claims, is that the Chinese have very little respect for intellectual property, or at least often in many cases. Tell us how you deal with that kind of whole pain of basically intellectual property theft, not to put too fine a point.
And I mean, there's not only theft, but if you have a very common product with no patent protections, there's no law that says that that company can't sell it to someone else. And of course, if you're just sourcing, they're already selling to multiple people. Our company, we try to not sell to people that would be competing against our competitors. It's not something that we can always perfectly balance, but our goal is to work with a smaller number of larger clients and try to be respectful enough of their special places in the market. Now, of course, if you're in a mold, no one else is going to use that mold. So unlike some Chinese factories, and I don't want to say all, but unlike some Chinese factories, you know, we're not going to be selling your product out the back door to other people.
Yeah.
Can't guarantee that some other third party might see it on Amazon and develop their own molds. That's something we can't prevent.
No, of course.
But as far as the things that people are investing in that we're directly involved in, that's just... trust is a big thing we try to build with our clients and offer as unique, distinctive.
So I guess owning a mold is a kind of interesting balance between the purely legal protection of a patent, which of course one should probably try and get, but is way more expensive traditionally than just the mold costs you like $1,000 or something.
Not always possible in all product situations either.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, we'd get lawyers on to talk about that. I'm sure we will. But your side of it is, if you own the mold and it's a unique mold, at least you've got a physical kind of limitation for people just copying it. And yeah, sure, if they get it off Amazon and send it to a Chinese factory and say, make a mold for this, then I guess you're going to get some people copying you. But that's quite different from the whole thing of, as you say, them sending it out the back door. So how do you deal? I mean, do you even have any way of handling that situation? How do you deal with the backdoor sales, as it were? Say I've created some plastic mold for, you know, sort of, let's say key fobs or something for the sake of argument, or key sized objects. I've got a mold that has 20 cavities in it, so I can produce lots of variations. They're selling really well. And I paid you guys, you know, $10,000 to get the mold made. What sort of protection would I have around that, if any?
Yeah, so for all the key processes that we commonly do, we work directly with just the same manufacturers that we have a very, very close relationship with. Metal supplier is, we consider them part of our company. My mother calls the boss her Chinese son. So yeah, just an extension of our factory. Our mold maker, is the same way. We have our own room within their factory, a locked room where all our molds are kept. We have some very specific camouflage patterns that we work with the clients that they paid a few thousand dollars to develop for textile printing. And we have those in locked tubes for when they're needed for screen printing on the fabric. So we don't actually own the fabric, the factory that does the printing on the textiles, but we make sure that our screens are locked up there.
That makes sense. So in other words, you have it comes down to the quality of the relationships, and then having procedures in place that are common sense, like physically locking things away. And I guess like anything else, if somebody wants to break in, I always think of the famous story of the Concorde development back in the 60s. And in Paris, there was just some Soviet spy who was a chief engineer or something. I mean, you know, any system can be a beast if you really want to. But I guess you know, look, that was Concord, that was worth stealing. Whereas, you know, some moderately successful product on Amazon is probably less of an incentive to break through so many barriers, right? I guess people would just go, you know what, this isn't going to happen. Let's do something different.
Yeah, if a national government wants to get a hold of your mold, I might not be able to prevent that.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, that's fair enough. But yeah, I think it's good to get a sense of proportion about this stuff. They're not all things are equally stealable and what have you. And I suppose it's just very much the sort of things you were just saying is a bit like the kind of common sense police advice is like, you know, most burglars are opportunists, so don't leave your windows open and make sure you've double locked your door. And then they'll probably try something else. And I'd imagine that's probably going to be true for your products in China as well, right? If there's somebody else's mold that's easy to steal, they don't have a close relationship with the person who's helped develop it. They don't really care about them. And they don't have proper procedures in place to look after it, then of course it's going to be much easier to get that one and just produce products out the back door, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's for some of the factories out there, that's just the MO for business. That's, you know, if anyone comes willing to offer money, they'll make those products regardless of who paid for the mold. Again, not every factory in China is like that, but there's enough that it's a concern.
Yeah. So I guess it comes down to, again, one reason to work with somebody like yourself is just because you have those close relationships and that trust. I mean, and this is another thing that came up in the conversation is that the obsession with getting somebody on the ground in China you can trust, and mostly we come back down, whether rightly or wrongly. And I suppose there can be accusations of racism here that might be fair as well. But rightly or wrongly, people are tending to think about British people or Americans on the ground, I guess partly because culturally, you know, there's a connection with a British or American person who understands traditional ways of business. Yeah. And yeah, and things that are familiar and ways of operating, and I suppose a culture as well of operating. For example, I mean, this is one of the things that I've always experienced, and be interesting to talk to you about this, that when I speak to a Chinese manufacturer, sometimes I still forget that in East Asian culture, in China or Japan, it's basically very rude to say no. So if I say, can you do this for XYZ date, if I phrase things in a crass way, for an American particularly, that's very normal. For Brits, that's still a bit aggressive because we are a little bit like the Asians in the sense of not wanting to be rude. But yeah, we'll ultimately say, I'm so sorry, old chap, I can't do that. But the Chinese would just say yes and then not do it. So is there a way around that you found? Is that a cultural difference we can overcome in some way?
That's definitely a Chinese cultural thing. Yes, saying no is not common. In business, I mean, I don't know how much that's going to play a part in business, but I guess what I see a lot is that if a factory can't do something, yeah, there's both because of the financial incentive as well. They're going to want to come back to you and say, sure, we can do that, but they're going to get you something that's 2/3 of the way of what you actually wanted. Would be a more common situation, as you say, both because of the cultural reason and because of the financial incentive. What would I recommend for someone trying to get around that problem? Just really pin down your supplier, or just really talk them through, you know, make them repeat over and over in writing or in a contract. Now, contracts, of course, are very hard to enforce internationally, but still, get them to put it down in writing. What, you know, you're sure you can hit the specifications. You're sure that's not going to be a problem. All right, put that in the purchasing order for me so that we can all see it there later.
Yeah. Okay. So like getting things down in writing and being very specific. I think the word pin down is the phrase that always springs to mind for me. I mean, this is only, mind you, with private label products with minimum tweaks is it's still an issue like, okay, can you make this? I mean, yeah, I'm just thinking about some things like, can you make this with the satin finish? Yes, no problem at all. And then they produce it with a sort of hard plastic shiny gloss finish, for example, with a plastic product that I had made. And you just think, sorry, which bit of the conversation didn't we get here? So I guess it comes down to getting photographs.
It could have been a communication issue, or it could have been as just the issue you were referring to a moment ago. It's hard to say, but yeah, that's a lot of my life wading through those problems. Samples. Actually, that would be my strong advice. Just, you know, don't get the 10,000 pieces and then inspect them. Get that sample. Make sure that's actually our business's core quality control key point is just about, we're not going to make something you've approved the sample. It's all right. I'm sure it'll be fine. Send it to me anyway, or just send me the mass product anyway. Get it on the ocean first. Yeah, you know, I try to really resist that at all costs. and just, you know, you need to get the sample in hand and tell us it's okay after you get the sample in hand and make sure. If you say it's okay, we can ensure that all the rest of the product's going to be manufactured to the same specifications as that. So for a buyer who's dealing with another Chinese party, I would strongly recommend that as well, both for the communication issue or for that. There's a phrase in Chinese called cha bedua, which means close enough. But it's a very, very dangerous phrase in the manufacturing world.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think you're, you know, I'm sure that you're resistant to the hard, hard experience of many, many years. I mean, absolutely. I'm one of those classic impatient people and say, oh, it will be good enough, because I'm used to Western levels of quality control, which generally there's so much regulation in the European Union and I guess in America around this stuff. It doesn't guarantee you're going to get great stuff either. But I mean, I think that, you know, or Japan, I mean, that they've got such high quality control built into the processes now, thanks to people like Denning and then Toyota. And it's come back from the Denning idea in America, went over to, you know, the Japanese bought it wholesale. And then it's gradually come back into, for example, American car manufacturing. But yeah, it somehow just isn't built in with Chinese stuff. And I guess as spoiled Western consumers, we forget that. I can't agree more that whenever I've tried to speed the process up and skip stuff, it's always bitten me so hard in the bum. I'm never going to do that again. If, for example, even skipping pre-shipment inspection, my partner and I just imported like 200 units or something. It's just a little test order and we couldn't be bothered to pay for QC. But then he spent 6 hours going through some boxes yesterday or whatever, a day before, just finding a bunch of defects that if we got it inspected in China, somebody on a much lower wage would have caught those. So yeah, another example.
Well, you have to weigh your risks with everything. You know, is the risk of it all turning out terrible? You know, having very few sellable products, is that worth the cost of inspecting for a small project? Obviously, for larger projects, it's worth it.
Even small projects. I mean, it surprised me, that tiny little example with the 200 units or something that is private label. Somebody else is doing the manufacturing. Somebody else has dealt with everything. And we just kind of, you know, got a special arrangement with somebody to just get a few units of it to sort of test out new products. But the point being, even in that silly little scenario, it still wasn't worth skipping QC, even though it seemed like it wouldn't. How could it possibly be worth spending $100 on this thing that was only going to cost us a few hundred? So yeah, there's an example that's never worth skipping.
With custom manufacturing and QC, that every product is also very different. Again, is again true here. I mean, if you have a plastic part that's just out of a plastic mold, really checking. I can't say it's universally true, but checking one and checking them all of them is generally going to be the same. There are issues that could go wrong, so I don't want to say that absolutely. But a batch is a batch. Shipping over you off of that batch serves the purpose largely. But then again, if you really want to be 100% sure, then QC inspection might still be appropriate in that. But you have to make that call yourself. I noticed one thing in the Chinese just economy that's kind of where some of this mentality is derived from, is the cost of manufacturing has traditionally been so cheap here. Obviously, it's a little more expensive than it was 10 and 15 and 20 years ago. But a lot of the factories have a mentality of, it's going to be cheaper and faster to just take a swing at this and hope we understood what the client was after here, or do it this cheaper way that we know the client didn't really want, but we're still going to try it this cheaper way. Send them some samples, send them some products, see if it's approved so that we can make some better margin. And if it's not, we'll come back and we'll redo the whole thing.
And that makes sense. I mean, I guess that's why the pre-shipment inspection is so important, because of that mentality. And it does make sense. I mean, there is a logic that drives all these situations. I mean, culture comes from, I think, necessity sometimes. I mean, discuss, okay, this is a very deep anthropological question. But I do think, yeah, you're right about if the cost of labor is super cheap, you just throw more labor at it. And that's why, mm-hmm. I guess, having the traditionally with the private label products, anywhere, the way that I've always done it, the usual 70-30 split, so or whatever you can get, 30% down up front, and then you hold 70% until they've actually got it right. But the downside, of course, is you've got to be prepared for them to take the whatever time it takes to produce the new run and replace that stuff, right? So that's kind of a crude solution. Do you suggest having quality control or inspections earlier in the process when you're dealing with custom manufacturing?
Yes, for sure. Every project's different. Yeah, we try to save ourselves cost and risk. We try to do different checks at as many steps as possible. So if we're doing, let's just say a tent with maybe some custom plastic in it. So yeah, we'll We'll show the client the CAD drawings for it, have them approve those. And then we're getting to fabric, and maybe, and so we're going to send the client the fabric strips, or at least, you know, we're going to talk through them, send pictures, maybe make a prototype with that fabric before we go off and run the hundreds of rolls or whatever it might be for that. Because if we think we understand what the client was after, and we custom weave hundreds of rolls of fabric, and then the client says, "Oh no, we didn't talk about the how thick this fabric needed to be." Oh well, you know, we're all in trouble at that point. So yeah, as much as you can be a part of the process, confirming the materials, confirming at different steps, that's great. You know, sometimes there's a prototype involved. Sometimes we've got our final product, our raw materials. Every project's different, but yeah, more communication, the better chance you have of not ending up with the wrong thing when it shows up at your door. Or even when you go for a quality inspection and you've got 10,000 pink t-shirts when you wanted 10,000 red t-shirts, that's a problem for both of you still. You know, you put 30% down, and you know, ideally that manufacturer is going to say sorry and rerun it all. But as you pointed out already, at the least you've lost time, which might be very critical for your business model.
Yeah. So as you say, it comes back to that old thing that carpenters used to say, right? Which is measure twice, cut once. And I guess that in the case of manufacturing a custom manufactured product with a serious number of run of pieces or units, measure like 10 times is better. And the other thing to say is this concept that Ashley Pierce talked about, who's a member of the 10K Collective. So he's actually doing relatively modest numbers relative to the sort of level you were talking about, probably, I don't know what sorts of turnover, but he had 100K Christmas, last year. So, you know, but he's got a manufacturing background. He was talking about the way that he would do it. And he talks on the podcast at some length about different subjects. But one thing was, he said, I think he basically nicked the idea from Tesco's or some major British company, which is that they have a bronze, silver, and a gold sample. So in other words, you don't even go in with the mentality as the buyer of the products of thinking that it's going to be right first time or even second time. You go in with the mentality, okay, here's a rough sample that comes back after the initial discussions, and you go, okay, well, this is good, this is good, this is good, that's rough, that's the wrong material, that's actually not flexible enough, it doesn't perform its function. And by the way, I'd forgotten, like you said, you know what, I completely forgot to talk about the thickness of the fabric, that's really stupid of me, well, can we make it a millimeter thicker or whatever? You go back, you have the silver sample, you come back and say, yeah, that's pretty good actually, but it needs this, 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 you still got some rough edges here, blah, blah, blah. And then they bring back the gold sample, which in theory, if life has neatly played ball, then that is your manufacturing sample. Yeah. So presumably that's just another way of putting all the stuff you've been implying the whole time, right? So to sample, 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 like you said.
So yeah, when we start talking with the client, I have to try to figure out and sort through in my mind, what are they ready for here? Are they ready for prototyping? Are they ready for sampling? Or are we ready to move into an order, which is going to include a sample process? But when you put 30% down, we're going to move towards what we might call a production sample. If all the details are clear, then we're into a production sample where we're buying the raw materials in bulk and making that happen. Now, there's always going to be some tension there, how to wade through that. If we're doing a tent and you need a very custom material that's very unique and a very specific color, and we're trying to do a prototype without putting our 30% down, there's going to be a problem there, because the minimum to weave and dye a fabric is going to be, you know, maybe it's going to be thousands of dollars worth of product at least. And no one wants to spend thousands of dollars on your typical prototype. So there's some tension about how to balance that. How approximate do you need your prototype to be, your sample to be, conceptual sample, before we get to a production sample?
Now, that's an interesting point, though. I think the tension between these different things is just part and parcel of, I think, if the entrepreneur, if they're really standing back from the process and just thinking in a properly business-like way, that back and forth is part of the decision of what sort of product line to pursue, right? I mean, you think this fabric, this type of tent with a really differentiated look and feel could really be differentiated from everything else out there. It's going to be unique. Custom in manufacturing, so therefore it's going to be defensible. That sounds great. The budget looks like XYZ on paper, but then you go in and actually one barrier to entry that could be too big a risk would be to spend $10,000 just to get the prototype done, and you discover it's not what you want. That's part of the investment of your time and money that your company should be making that I think is the right call for man. In other words, how can I put this? Things don't go in a linear way. They don't go, right, idea, talk to manufacturer, make the prototype, do the next thing, do the next thing, do the next thing, done. It's a back and forth process. And part of that process is discovering in the nuts and bolts way of actually, you know what, we shouldn't be doing this. This doesn't make sense for a company.
That happens.
Yeah. And that's real life, right? And I just think it's odd how long that life should be linear and go from A to Z in one nice way, how long that mentality persists. And what I think that means is even for a very good entrepreneur, that they end up giving themselves a hard time because they haven't got a product out the door because they gave themselves 6 months to do it, when they didn't allow for the fact that 6 months is a good goal, but we aren't obsessed with that being a reality. And also this product line may not pan out, and that's fine because that's part of life. As long as you've got more than one iron in the fire, it's okay, right?
Yeah. When those kind of things happen, most of my clients, you know, they know they're part of the process and we're part of the process. But occasionally, yeah, we'll have the client who they're making changes. They're saying, yeah, okay, we do the prototype that they want. And they're making changes. We're redoing a prototype. You know, there's some minor costs involved in all the back and forth. And then they get frustrated with the timeline when they didn't come to us with all those details. And they're making changes as they see things and play with things in their hands. And they just can't handle the timeline that's resulting from it. And that's, as you say, just part of one of the entrepreneurial challenges that we have to balance and see how fast we can push through this with still getting everything we want.
Absolutely. I mean, I just think, just to come back to that again, I mean, just to hammer this home, one of the definitions of economics is the allocation of scarce resources. In other words, there is a limited amount of time and money available, and the art is allocating it. In other words, so that implies it's not always going to work out. And it's the decision of where to put it is, I think, the ultimate entrepreneurial or even investor decision. But also, yeah, as you said, I mean, if you're going to move the goalpost yourself, and my God, I've been that person so many times, so I feel a bit guilty now, but I've been the person making a process last longer. And another thing, my coach, Jason Miles, who's not a custom manufacturing person, but runs Shopify training and Shopify store, he says, look, there's a continuum between speed and quality. And again, that's another decision on entrepreneurs to make. If you think it's Christmas is coming up in 9 months' time and you can get a product out for Christmas and make a killing, even if it's not the most amazingly produced products in the world, then that's a speed, you know, pushes you towards speed in a very calm business-led decision. Absolutely. Just impatience versus if something's out there already and the market, you know, the minimum viable product needs to be very, very good, then you're just going to have to take longer. And you're right to reject sample after sample. And I guess, as you say, you know, the cost of that is it takes you 18 months to get out the door. And that's how it is. So,
And we deal with a lot of different clients. And, you know, there's both sides of the spectrum of clients that we've dealt with, some that are just meticulous, and some that are just whatever, doesn't matter. Just give me something out the door. And yeah, so we try to balance both of those out and keep things at a good pace. But
I mean, the whatever, get it out of the door mentality. I mean, the only thing I can say about that is that the Amazon customer, as we all know, is not very good at whatever it does the job. If there's some tiny wrinkle on the packaging and they're having a bad hair day, suddenly you got a one-star review looking at you, right? And then it's going to take a lot of work and expense to get a five-star review, particularly now. It's so hard to get reviews. Without risking your account. So yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you one frustration I've had with that type of client before is that, you know, they'll say any color's fine, make it whatever color you think best. Okay. Make it whatever color we make. And then they get a couple of negative reviews. Pink? Why'd you do it in pink? They come back to me. Why'd you do it in pink?
Yeah. Passing of bucks. Number one, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you fail to make a decision, you basically, you're responsible for what it results, I think. I guess, again, a lot of it comes down to entrepreneurial responsibility, right? You're in charge, but you're also responsible. So like, if you make a stupid decision, then it's good to be grown up enough to have known up to it. Let's just deal with the final area that I think you guys deal with, which is the whole question of freight. Because obviously, as you said, supply chain is the right word. So we're going earlier in the supply chain. But once you've created the mold and all the prototype and all the pain and excitement as well of all of that stuff, you've got 10,000 units waiting somewhere on the edge of a Chinese factory. obviously the rest of the supply chain is not inconsiderable, both in terms of the cost and the time. We've talked about those two key metrics, you know, money and time. Is that something you guys deal with?
Absolutely. It's another one of our unique values we try to offer our clients. We do monthly shipments to our warehouse in the US. We also have a US company that we own that we ship to our warehouse there, where we can break up our shipments for our various clients. It creates a lot, and we handle the importing there as well. So for our smaller clients that are importing a couple, two, three pallets at a time, it saves them a ton of money, because you know your minimum cost for importing a single paperclip if you ship it ocean might cost you around $700 to $800 just to import that one thing, just because the paperwork and the warehouse.
I love the idea of sea shipping a paperclip, by the way, but that's like the rawest test of the basic raw number, right? That's a kind of fun experiment. $700,
okay. Your minimum costs there. And so for that client that needs us to ship a paperclip, well, we'll tell them, go away. But, but in theory, for that client who has the small shipment, that you know, we can save them $650 off of that, because we're sharing those costs amongst one or multiple containers in a shipment.
And that's really huge, actually. I want to underscore just how absolutely huge that is, because, I mean, otherwise minimum order quantities aren't so much about the manufacturer's side as what will work with the container. And you can do all sorts of very complex maths to figure out the optimization of stuffing a container. But in the end of the day, if your minimum shipping unit is a container, you have to be dealing in rather frightening amounts of bulk, and that increases risk, right?
Depending on the product. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. If our clients choose to have our company be the importer, then we can handle all the importing process. We can advise on the probable tax rates beforehand. We're the importer. We handle all those paperwork, and we ship our clients' products directly to FBA as they request. You gotta send us all your labels and line that up beforehand, but we can slap labels on everything and get it to your FBA warehouse when you're just shipping in smaller pallet size. And then, yeah, tariffs and the import duties, we do our best to navigate that. If you want us to commit to a delivered door-to-door price with tariffs, we can commit to that. Or you might actually, you know, we're going to, if it's not a clear categorization, we're going to add a few percentage points in there. If it is a clear categorization, what the expected cost there is. But if you want to pay those yourselves, we can just advise on what it's probably going to be, and we'll see what it is after it's imported. You know, right now with the Trump-China trade wars, there's a lot of uncertainty there as well. I don't know if that's dating our conversation right now and how that's gonna work out in the short term. You know, it might all go away next month, or it might get a lot more intense. But we try to be on top of that as well, and could advise our clients about what they expect if they start a project right now versus January, February. There's going to be some shifts in that if they don't work things out. The nice thing about the trade war, though, is the Chinese currency has gone down 10%. And so a lot of the tariffs right now are 10%, but the currency is a little more complicated than this and the effects of it. But if you're ordering a product last year that you're still ordering this year, and you haven't inquired with your supplier about, hey, can we get a lower price on this based on the US dollar price? Because Chinese currency is down.
Interesting. So presumably that's down against the dollar, by the way. I haven't checked it against the pound, because
Against the dollar. Chinese currency is generally down because of the trade war. Hmm. So product prices in Chinese currency in any currency should be lower than last year. Of course, in the long term, that starts to affect raw materials, and it's a complicated thing.
Certainly, yeah. So if you're listening sort of autumn 2018 when we're recording this, I mean, I guess that's very hot tip, actually, because I hadn't really thought that one through. And I thought, okay, the other competition, I thought it in terms of the economics, obviously all the importers from China who are selling on Amazon, for that matter, anywhere else in the US, are going to be adding, you know, whatever the net amount is of the tariffs. And thus the market price as a whole will go up. And then basically the competition will be around the same price probably. And it turns out to be true in some markets and not others. But what I hadn't really thought about is the effects in the Chinese currency, and thus ultimately that balances back out. So that's a really important insight you've just gained. So so it's really worth going back to your manufacturer.
I think at the moment we're down about 11. Yeah, we're down about 11% versus the US dollar versus before the trade wars started, and most of the tariffs are at 10%. And at least getting 5% cheaper out of your manufacturer should be a strong possibility.
Excellent. Well, that's a really, really top tip. I mean, talk about a tactical tip with a massive impact. That's fantastic. So thank you for pointing that out. So yeah, it just really sounds like you can do almost a sort of process. So you can create a product from a sketch on a back of a napkin and an idea, and then get it all the way through manufacturing and get it across the US and into Amazon, or for that matter, anywhere else.
We have made products that started with clients' napkin sketches.
That is amazing. So you guys really are some powerful people to know. And I think, you know, if I were looking for an answer, and this is not some kind of, and this is real, it's not just an artificial made up, but if I were looking for an answer to this person saying, God, I just really need an American manufacturer, American kind of contact on the ground in China to help me develop my custom products. And if I'd known about you guys at that point, it would have been a very normal thing to say, you know what, actually, you should check these guys out, Ryan Shaffett of XQ Manufacturing. They seem to know their business. So that's a British way of saying they're awesome, by the way. Sorry, that sounds rather understated to American ears, I'm sure. But those their business. That's a high praise as far as I'm concerned. So tell us a little bit more, Ryan, about if somebody wants to get in touch with you or find out more about XQ, so make sure I get it right, XQ Manufacturing. How do they get in touch? Sure.
Yeah, visit our webpage at xqmanufacturing.com. Send me an email at rs@xqmanufacturing.com. Love to start a conversation. You know, all projects start with a good conversation, trying to understand what you are after. We try to move to general quotes pretty quickly, depending on the project. And we can quote you out on your project, or at least give you a ballpark at what you might be expecting. And it'll help you evaluate if this is something, help you save time as you evaluate, is this something you want to continue pushing forward with, or maybe need to find another product that might pencil out better.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that always strikes me, is that if somebody like yourself is willing to have a conversation with somebody, that conversation in itself is very, very valuable, because you've been here and bought the t-shirt, gone to all the rodeos and, you know, all the other cliches. You've done this a billion times, whereas for most people, even those who are relative to private label manufacturers, quite big players doing a few million dollars a year, in the wider scheme of things, they have very, very little experience of custom manufacturing unless they happen to have been doing it. So extremely worth a conversation with you, if nothing else.
Yeah. And even for those clients who have a fairly good direction about what they want, just as a manufacturer, we love to, you know, hopefully we're still able to advise them about, you know, have you considered this or that? That might save you a lot of per piece cost on this, or allow you later flexibility down the road. And just from a manufacturer's perspective, be able to hopefully chime in and add to the conversation, even for those who already have a pretty solid direction about what they want to see as an end product.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And here's the other thing that always strikes me. And if you look at some like Tiger Woods, I mean, he's probably not the flavor of the month anymore from the last few years, but he was a go-to quote at one point. He had 7 coaches. And that's not because the guy can't play golf. The guy could play golf because he had 7 coaches. So in other words, if you're humble enough to ask an expert in an area where it's manufacturing, or get a cost accountant in, or you know, an intellectual property lawyer or whatever it is, if you're humble enough to ask an expert their opinion, they may well tweak processes you've been doing for a decade and save you a ton of hassle or money, right? It's always worth asking an expert. That's why we have you on the show. So Ryan, just remains for me to say, very insightful. I've probably asked a lot of dumb newbie questions, but I guess that at least a certain percentage of the listeners, even if they're doing what by our lights are some decent numbers on Amazon, are still going to have some of those questions, but also some very clear-minded answers on some quite complex topics. And also, obviously, you sound like a very, very good person to just have a conversation with at the very least, if you're considering doing custom manufacturing. So thank you very, very much for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to do this, and thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US dollars or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.